It's a pleasure to be with you all here today. If you're on the call, go ahead and turn on your screens. Put down all technology and just be present with us here for the next 57 minutes we have on this call here today. For those of you who are maybe coming to this for the first time, this is a ReLeaders member-only event. We sent this invitation out to all 85 members. We have about 30 RSVPs today. One of the things that I think our forum does is if someone doesn't show up, we try and reach out to those members, say, hey, we'd love to have you on this call here today. We miss you. We want you to be here. So if that's, you know, a member that's maybe say, hey, I want to be here, or maybe they should be at this event, just please send them a quick email and let them know that you want them to be here. Other than that, we have a great presentation for you all today, great member event. The format today is 40 minutes of a discussion with these two incredible individuals, Elaine Rasmussen and Miren Oka of Oka Aquatics. And we're going to go into a couple different topics here today. One, we're going to kind of talk about their backgrounds, why they're on this call, their journey with employee ownership and perpetual purpose trust, EOTs. And I think, you know, just before this meeting, we were all talking a little bit beforehand, and I think it's very clear that employee ownership is unclear still. It is still this kind of new frontier of ownership. And that's why I think it's really, really important that, you know, we are on the cutting edge of these conversations. I want to say, Miren, we said it was around 30 to 50 employee-owned trusts currently here in the United States. So the wild, wild west still. And I think, you know, this is a great community to be in, to learn not just from lawyers, but the CEOs who have actually gone through this experience themselves. So please be present, turn on your screens, and be ready to ask questions at the 40-minute mark. With that being said, we'd love to kick it off with a quick little introduction from both Elaine and Miren. So Elaine, we'd love to hear from you and a little bit about your background with employee ownership.
Sure. Hello, everybody. It's so great to see you today and have you join us for this really great conversation. Once again, my name is Elaine Rasmussen. I am the CEO of Social Impact Now. We are a social finance and impact investing advisory firm. We work with organizations, individuals, and governments around developing innovative community-based solutions, but also alternative social finance options. So my experience with dealing with employee-owned trusts, I've been through them actually myself a few different times. There's been there was a set of organizations, six of us that were nonprofit organizations that got together to build a perpetual purpose trust. I have a colleague of mine who I supported through an employee ownership trust creation, as well as some iterations of those in between. And we'll talk a little bit more about those, but really excited to just share my knowledge and my experience, and got a chance to spend some time offline with Miren and Kevin. So I'm really excited to learn more about her perspectives and what she has to share as well.
Well, that's the beauty of this thing, Elaine. We're going to get a lot of different angles on employee ownership today. And if we can see different things from different angles, we're going to have a more of a holistic understanding of how to navigate this. So Miren, your background with employee ownership.
So thank you. My name is Miren Oka. I'm the founder and CEO of Oka Aquatic Swim School. We just celebrated our 30-year anniversary in business. And so I started the business in the middle of college. I was actually in college. I was at the school of my dreams, getting my degree in biochemistry, you know, all of that. And I got pregnant in college. So I kind of had to start a business to feed my growing family. And that's how the business started. So 30 years ago, the business was very different than it is today. Today, we have 5 indoor warm water locations. We teach 6,500 swimming lessons a week. And it's really grown. And it's just grown into this amazing you know, business with a lot of 165 team members. And so that's what we wanted to preserve. And that's why we started looking, you know, down this route. And so I'm excited to talk about it today.
Well, thank you, Miren. I'm gonna go right back to you. I mean, this was a conversation, and now we can talk about it, that, you know, you really brought to forum, I'm gonna say almost a year and a half ago. And we were just celebrating the final succession or exit, I guess, alternative exit of this business into your PPT. So I want to learn about maybe how you first got exposed to this concept.
So I started looking at employee ownership options in November of 2021. And I have a son, I have a 32-year-old son. And so I went to him and said, you know, it would have been ideal had he come into the business and wanted to do the business, but this was not his interest. It's not his path. It's not what he wanted. So I kind of gave him veto power. And I told him if he wasn't going to come in, I really did want to transition this to the employees. So I looked at various, you know, do it yourself, like phantom stock. How are we going to let people buy into the business? Just different mechanisms like that. And I talked to a lot of different business owners that had done things like that. And then I looked at a co-op, because the co-op was kind of intriguing to me. There were a couple of reasons why that just didn't fit. I looked at ESOPs, went down the path, did evaluation, did feasibility studies, you know, went down that journey. We can talk about that more if you'd like in a little bit. And then I ran across somebody who was transitioning from an ESOP to an EOT. And it just sounded perfect. It sounded like, oh my gosh, you know? So that was about a year and a half ago. I found that instrument, the EOT. I had no idea what it was. And then really started looking at that, really started doing research, engaged an attorney, did all of the work behind it. It took us about 9 months to officially transition, but it was just the best fit for us, for what we wanted. And again, I can go into all of that, but I don't know if you want to talk about that in a little bit, but it just, the journey went through all the different possibilities of employee ownership.
Well, and we'll pause right there. We'll go back to the journey in just a bit. Before we do, Elaine, when were you first introduced to this concept? And I mean, obviously this was a hot topic in the Unite group chat on WhatsApp. So when I posted about it, everyone was like, hey, I want to learn more about what this whole concept is about. When did you first get introduced to this?
So the first introduction I got into this was being in Minnesota. We are actually one of the largest states that has the most cooperatives in general. So it's a very normed thought of employee ownership, cooperative ownership. We actually have Shared Capital is headquartered here, North Country Foundation, which was an organization to support employee ownership was headquartered here. So the notion was already here when I moved here about almost 20 years ago. And then when I started my company 6 years ago, I knew that I was already planning my exit. I knew that I wanted to sell my company to the employees. So I had that. And then my more formal introduction into it was being a part of an impact conveners that six of us came together and were thinking about what would it look like since we are all doing these sort of impact convenings, what would it look like if we were one organization that every organization benefited from and we didn't have this treadmill of fund development that we had to constantly do, but what could it look like if the organization was in this perpetual purpose trust that then allowed for more scalability, more sustainability across all these organizations that had this impact focus and impact mission as their collective center.
And Elaine, in your experience of working with a lot of these entrepreneurs that are kind of going through this transition, in your experience, what do they have in common? Like, what is maybe the sole kind of overarching reason that they decide to explore this alternative exit?
I find that there's a couple of reasons. One is creating a more equity as far as people who've been left out of traditional financial systems or financial benefit. So really wanting to create some equitable mechanism that allows that to happen. But the other part is just really wanting to have impact in some sort of way, whether that be environmental, whether that be around a cause or around a set of humans, whether that be ethnic, whether that be a geographical, but it's really about how can we decentralize our current hierarchical financial structure.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mary, before we go into the journey, I'm going to ask you a couple technical questions here. If I was in the audience, I would just want to know maybe what is a perpetual purpose trust in your words? You mentioned a few other alternatives such as ESOPs, phantom stocks earlier. Could mm-hmm. you maybe just give us a quick understanding of what these terms mean and how they differ?
Well, I think you know, so I'm not a legal professional, so I couldn't go into things in great depth, but I think you had some really good blurbs at the beginning about what a trust is. And a trust, you know, one of the things that we wanted to do with a perpetual purpose trust, we just saw that Patagonia a few years ago transition to a perpetual purpose trust, and the beneficiary was the environment. So the perpetual purpose trust, and I know Elaine and I were talking about this before, has a beneficiary, and it could be, in our case, it's an employee ownership trust. So ours, the beneficial owners are the employees. And that's why we chose to go in that, because it's a trust that is a very flexible trust. So I could design how I wanted it to be. I could put in there what sort of benefits I wanted to live for the duration of the trust. I'm in the state of Florida, so it's a 1,000-year trust. So my goal is that Oak Aquatics lives for 1,000 years and is a model to other organizations that want to continue doing this. But that trust instrument is really important for that. An ESOP is an employee stock ownership plan, and it is where you're selling also to a trust, but it is different because it's governed by ERISA and the Department of Labor. So there's a lot more oversight. There's a lot more, it's a more costly instrument to put into place. It probably would have cost us 5 or 6 times more than what we paid to do our EOT, but then there are some significant tax savings if you do an ESOP. So that's what's appealing to some people. And then the co-op was really interesting because it's more like a democratic model where we found that, you know, everyone gets a vote, and it's a little bit different. Right now, we have a board of directors that actually, you know, I've heard it said with EOTs, that everything changes, but nothing changes. So yes, technically the ownership changed, but really operationally nothing changed. We still have our group of managers. We still have our board of directors. You know, we still have everything that we have in place that's gonna operate the day-to-day business. So whereas in a co-op, it might be a little bit different. So when we were looking at all those different options, we just saw what fit the majority of the things that I was looking for, and the EOT kind of checked all those boxes.
Thanks for sharing it. And Elaine, in your experience with the difference between profit sharing and employee ownership trusts, is there any, like, I guess, repetitive confusion or misunderstandings of what an employee owned trust is?
Absolutely. So one of the things, and we talked a little bit about this offline, is they're all different categories, right? But then there's also this umbrella term of perpetual purpose trusts. And Miran talked a little bit about that. So you can have an employee-owned trust. You can have an ESOP, which is different than a cooperative, right? And which is different than, there's all these other sort of democratized way of structures. So I think what was great about what Miran shared was, like, she kind of went through examining all of those and really looking at the pros and cons, and that in and of itself is a process, not only for you, particularly if you're the founder, of really deciding what is the impact that I'm looking to make with this opportunity, how long do I want to make this, those sorts of questions really have to be examined. But then also examining, you know, Maren talked about her son not wanting to come into the business. Do the employees want to come into the business? Because that's a real thing that has to be answered. And then there's a whole education curve that needs to happen there before you can even start the process. So understanding that there's this umbrella term, and if it sounds murky, that's because it kind of is. as Miran said, like, we're not lawyers or accountants, and you definitely need those two people to go through this process. I would not recommend anybody trying to do this on their own. It is not a DIY process, even for a cooperative, quite frankly, it is not a DIY process. But once you kind of answer some elemental questions, I think, as Miran demonstrated in talking about her experience, you start to right swipe and left swipe on some things, and then it becomes clear what your options are. You may come out with really only one or two options that make sense for you, the organization, and the people that you're looking to entrust the organization with.
Thanks for sharing that, Elaine. Miran, going back now to the journey, I think what was so interesting about you throughout this journey is, like, you were just constantly on, like, almost like a war path, trying to find everyone and anyone who had had experience in all of these different alternative exits. Tell us a little bit more about what you went through and what maybe clarified this decision to go with the EOT.
Well, and Kevin, what Kevin's talking about is I'm actually in his forum and I was always searching for, does anyone know anyone who has anything to do with employee ownership? And employee ownership in the US is they count a firm as employee owned as long as 30% or more is owned by the employees. There are about 7,000 different companies in the US that qualify to have that title. And I wanted to speak to all of them, basically. I was looking to speak to as many people with as many different ways of ownership. So I did speak to quite a few ESOPs, a lot of different CEOs of ESOPs, employee stock ownership plans. I spoke to quite a few co-ops. I spoke to people who did it, you know, DIY, phantom stock, that kind of thing. I also spoke to a couple, I really wanted people who had done ESOPs and then moved away from ESOPs, like it had been a failure kind of thing. I wanted to talk to different organizations that had tried things that didn't work. And so throughout that whole process, that's where I started to learn about the things that were really the sticky points, like with an ESOP and the ERISA oversight. You have to be really prepared. Yes, there's some amazing tax benefits, but you have to be prepared to have those, the big fees up front, but also the ongoing administrative fees every year. You have to know that you are a retirement plan that is going to be have a lot of oversight. And so some people are really struggling with that. And so that's where I found somebody who was going from an ESOP to an EOT. I had never heard of that before. And then I actually went to a conference and heard someone speak about it as well. And that's when I decided, let me dig into that a little bit. But it was really hard. It was really hard to find other EOTs in the country because, like I said, I think they're about 30. I think we're around number 30 right now. And now we're gathering everybody together so that if people have questions, you know, there are different companies of different sizes that have gone through this process. And it has been something that's good to have a community of EOTs to, you know, figure out how they're working through some of the logistics. Now, EOTs are not completely brand new on the planet because it's actually the primary source of ownership in the United Kingdom. So they have been done before. They are more prevalent there, but it's just, it's something new here in the US. So.
Thanks for sharing that, Miren. Elaine, one of the things I'm currently thinking about is just like the variety of businesses on this call. There are so many different industries on this call right now and at so many different stages. Are EOTs for everybody?
Wow, that's a great question. I think the answer to that question is no different than any other sort of governance question with an organization, right? Because that's what we're talking about. We're talking about a governance structure that has financial implications. So I think if you were to convert to a governance structure that had three CEOs, for example, like, does that make sense for everybody or even within the same industry? I don't even think it's a question of industry. It's really about, I think, that organization and what are the things of that organization that make it ripe to go through this process. But I'd love to hear from Miren about those CEOs that you talked to have failed ESOPs and what they had to say. Was it industry specific? Was it organizational specific? Was it culture specific? Because what I find is where these things fall apart even before you get that far down the track is it's not a culture alignment, right? And so if the culture alignment isn't there, I don't know that you're going to be successful in the short run or the long run.
Yeah, Miren, your thoughts?
So really interesting. You brought up some good points because the CEOs that I'd spoken to, yes, they did bring up that cultural alignment was not there. I think they were hoping, there were some of them that were hoping that an ESOP would suddenly turn on a switch and their team members would now have this ownership mindset. And where what we found is for 2 years, we've actually been talking about this ownership mindset and ownership thinking. And so we have 5 different locations. We have 25 different managers. And it has been, you know, own it comes out of our mouth all the time. Like over the last 2 years, we'll just own it and do this. And oh, that's ownership, you know. So we've been really kind of working on that a lot. And many of the people that I spoke to that it didn't work out didn't have that culture and never really had an education process to get that afterwards. They just thought it would happen automatically. We've been very, very intentional about our education. The other thing, unfortunately, that happened was they transitioned right before COVID. And then going through COVID with the administrative fees associated with an ESOP, it didn't work for them to continue it. They really struggled with that. And then the other thing that I saw, you know, that I really felt was at the end of each year in an ESOP, the majority, you know, there might be some profit sharing also, but we get a piece of paper that showed this is how much stock I have. And some people didn't really understand what that meant. It wasn't something tangible to them. They didn't understand it until someone left, either retired, and then there was a repurchase obligation by the company, and that person ended up with money or retirement. And that's where it started to make sense to the team members because they saw that happening. But until that happened, they didn't really get it. And so we chose the EOT because it's a very, it's kind of an amped up form of profit sharing. So as employee owners, they get a share in the profit. So after all the debts are paid each year, there's a profit that's left and that is distributed amongst the team members that qualify for the EOT. Right now we have 165 team members, only 50 qualify because they have to have worked at least 2,500 hours to qualify in that profit share. And so what we're doing is half of it goes to them as a cash distribution, basically. It goes in a paycheck. And then the other half is going into their 401k. And so it's a diversified account. 401k is a little bit different than if I had done the ESOP. All of that retirement would have been going into their Oak Aquatics stock account. And they would have been building up their retirement all in Oak Aquatics stock. And, you know, Oak Aquatics teaches swimming lessons. We're a very high liability industry. And there was always that concern of I'm putting all their retirement eggs into one basket. And I really wanted, and I know we could have also put some in 401k. We've had a 401k for 15 years, but still I was really worried about the bulk of that money going into Oak Aquatics stock. And, you know, I worried about what happens if competitive penetration, what happens if rising floodwaters in Miami and we can't teach swimming lessons in 20 years, you know, all those things. I didn't want to hurt their retirement. So the EOT seemed like, again, it just checked the right boxes and it was the best fit for us.
Amirin, communicating this to CEOs on the call is one thing, but also communicating to your employees is a whole nother. You just went through this process. I think it was in March. Tell us a little bit about how you plan to communicate this to the individuals who are now receiving shares of the profit.
Yes, so we have been employee owned for officially 47 days now. So I am the expert experienced person on the call. I don't know if I qualify to even talk about this yet, but what we did, we transitioned March 1st. We had a team member event on March 3rd in person. They all thought they were coming for us to announce that we were gonna open a sixth location. It was really quite cool. What I did was just talk to them. We did a kind of, you know, Oak Aquatics through the ages. We talked about the last 30 years. I talked about we get approached by private equity every week. I mean, every week. It's a huge thing right now in the industry, trying to all the child activities. So, and I talked to them about private equity. I talked to them about what that meant in some of my friends who have sold to private equity and what has happened in those swim schools. And I did tell them that at that meeting, I decided to sell the company. And, you know, in the audience, you saw everybody like, oh my gosh, what, you know, why? And then I had on the screen, you know, I decided to sell it to employee ownership trust. I went through, I explained what that meant. So there was a lot of confusion, shock, and then confusion, and then joy. Oh, people were really, really happy about it. You know, it became this kind of this evolution. So they moved through that. But since like the day after, we have AMAs, Ask Mirren Anything. And it's just a webinar where they can come on and ask me anything they want. And we talk about it. We've had educational sessions. We've had two in the last 47 days. We've had two with our attorney who can explain it, you know, in kind of more attorney language. But, you know, so he goes through, he explains it, he answers questions. I've had two webinars, and then we have financial meetings. We've had several financial meetings where we talk about, we're teaching them personal finances and professional finances so that they can understand what this means to them, what it looks like, and all of those things. So now all of the financial training didn't start in March 1st. It actually started 2 years ago. We've been doing a lot of different financial education, but now we're amping it up and we're really leveling them up in, you know, that regard. So we've done a ton of education about it.
So Kevin, if it's okay, I'd like to jump in here. Okay. So I want to offer a very different experience. So when I was going through our Perpetual Purpose Trust, it was six nonprofit organizations that had impact convenings that wanted to come together and do a trust. I think we were having conversations probably, if not monthly, we were having online conversations at least once a month, and then asynchronous conversations happening offline. And that process was a little close to a year and a half, right? So just want to give people a perspective of timeline. This is a long, because we're talking about six organizations with six busy CEOs. So just getting us, you know, the scheduling cats is already a problem. I didn't know what it was going to be, and I didn't know if my organization wanted to be a part of it. And so I really went on this faith journey with these other organizations because these were leaders that I admired and respected, had been working within the impact space. And so I there was a trust there that was already built for me to go through this process with them and see where it was going to go. And they were also okay with, we know that we don't know what this thing is and we're building the bridge while we're walking over it kind of thing. And so it wasn't until literally we were getting ready to like, oh, we built out the governance structure. Like we have like a 30-page PowerPoint of like, this is the structure. This is how it's going to run. This is where we were looking at 10%, I think 10% payouts that go to each organization. And then 10% or 20% was going to go back into the main trust. Like we'd worked through all of that. And when we got to the end and it was like a sack of rocks that hit me. I'm like, oh, I finally now understand what this thing is and we can't participate. And the reason why we couldn't participate was all of the other organizations only had one event, but we already had a growth plan that we were planning to do at least 30 events a year, which would then mean that we were disproportionately contributing and we would not proportionally be getting the financial benefit, and it was my intellectual property. So I personally would not be financially benefiting. And for me, that was not something that I could afford personally to do, was to just hand over my intellectual property and not be compensated for it. And so what was an interesting thing that came out of that was the other organizations moved forward, but they said to me, we still want you involved. How can you be involved in this trust in some way? And so then it just opened up the door of us having other conversations of we were looking to scale our production arm of our organization. So it's like, well, we can be the production arm of the trust and we can be a contracted vendor for the trust because they wanted a trusted vendor that they could then offload the production to. So it was just a really lovely, beautiful thing, even though I wasn't part of our organization, my nonprofit wasn't a part of the larger one. To go through that whole entire process, to come out of it still with a positive experience, but the experience being that I had to exit and having my own reasons why I did not go forward with the trust.
Miren, any comments on that, on what Elaine just shared?
You know, I think she's spot on when you say it's a lot. It takes a lot of work. It takes research. My experience was different in terms of I'm a single business and I was doing it on my own. And my team members didn't really know what I was doing. I spent a lot of money, like researching. I spent money hiring attorneys and doing valuations and doing feasibility studies and everything. But I have no regrets. I'm really glad that I spent that money to really research the alternatives, because you have to feel really comfortable with what you're doing. And so how she found out at the end that you're right, there are so many different things you learn along the way it's good to do research and to allow yourself, this isn't going to be done in 2 months. Even though some EOT companies could tell you, yeah, we can do this in 2 months. It really does take time and you're going to learn so much along the way. And it's worth it. it's worth taking the time to really think through every single possibility and then explore the other opportunities like Elaine just found. You know, that's amazing that it didn't work in the EOT way, but it worked in something else. Just like it didn't work for me the ESOP way, but I found something else that worked. I never would have found something else that worked had I not gone down that ESOP road. So it's just all part of the learning process.
And I will just say one last thing. What I think Maren will share in my sentiment is that even if you don't go forward with any of the options, you learn so much more about the organization that you didn't even know before. And it creates this unique opportunities of these decision points of going deeper in your governance, deeper in your leadership, deeper in your impact, in all these things, because you're forced to ask questions that may have been assumptions that you've been operating as norms, and kind of ask, do you want to make this a rule? And I think that that is a very unique distinction, and any process that allows you to get that more tightly woven fabric within the organization, I think is a good experience.
I think it was Yvon Chouinard that said, commit and then figure it out later. love that quote. Of course, not from another B Corp. But I want to take a quick pause here with about 5 minutes left in this conversation to the audience out there, just to challenge you to think of just one question for our panelists here today. No matter where you are on your journey, we've covered a lot, but we haven't covered your questions yet. So I just want you to think about one question. We'll open it up to everyone. We have 20 minutes. It's plenty of time. But just ask one question. It could be super small, or it could be a large overarching question that's going to stump our panelists here today. I don't know. But just think of just one question. Maren, here's my question. You kind of start off to do this thing to create this, 1,000-year-old business, right? Mm-hmm. Is it possible, though, that employees in the company could sell their shares, rise up and take over?
Absolutely. So, Kevin, that's a really great point. With an EOT, you design the trust. You put in there whatever you'd like. So I design the trust. So yes, it can be sold. If the company needs to be wound down, let's say Miami, there's, I'm just coming up with ideas for effect, but rising floodwaters and swimming lessons are not needed anymore, and robots are now teaching swimming, or whatever you want to come up with. And the company needs to be wound down, and it needs to be sold. So it can be sold. The employee owners can get together and sell the company. 75% of the proceeds will go to nonprofit. Mm-hmm. So, and in various categories that I have chosen and I put into the trust. 25% will go to the team members that have worked there the last 2 years. Mm-hmm. Because what we don't want is that all these owners that have built the company to what it is today, and then you terminate everybody, and then there are three owners left, and they are the ones who decide to sell the company. There are all those different things you have to think of. It's really hard to think of what could happen in 1,000 years or 500 years or 100 years. But I just tried to say, I don't want this company to be sold. I really want it to live on. We do important life-saving work. We teach swimming lessons, and we make families safer around the water. And we teach 6,500 swimming lessons a week. So we make an impact in the Miami community. But more than that, one of our guiding principles in our leadership team is model the behavior you want to see. And so by doing this, we're modeling the behavior we want to see. I want to see more employee ownership in the world, because I live in Miami, where people work very, 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 very hard and make a lot of money and live in really great places. And then there are people who work very, 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 very hard and don't. They have 8 people living in a 2-bedroom apartment paying $4,000 in rent. It's ridiculous. Miami has this crazy wealth gap. And so by doing this and by having our organization be a model of employee ownership, I think we help close the wealth gap a little bit in our community with the people who work with us. So that's my, pie in the sky BHAG. But I really feel, and that's why I want it to live on as long as it possibly can.
Love that. Thank you for sharing, Maren. Elaine, in closing here, of course, as a social impact strategist, I know you deal a lot with culture. What's been your experience in terms of the clients that have gone through this process with how it's impacted their culture? I know Miran just touched on hers a little bit. What's been your experience?
I think it's just putting an exclamation point on what Miran shared earlier. You find out very, very quickly that it's not for the faint-hearted. It's optimal when there is already an organizational culture that is grounded in impact, that's grounded in some kind of social equity, environmental equity. It's optimal when there is sort of this employees wanting to step in some sort of leadership or ownership position. Those are just some of the optimal ingredients for a great recipe. But to Miran's point earlier, if you're just trying to do this to fix something that's broken, it's not going to serve you. It's not going to do that at all. And that is demonstrated through all of these examples we've talked about when we talk about cooperatives, when we talk about, and I've even seen it happen with B Corps, right? I've seen it happen with employee ownership conversions. They fall apart when there isn't a sort of underlying base culture that is somehow aligned around impact, that is aligned around equity, that's aligned around some sort of common good or common purpose.
Kevin, to piggyback on what she said, you know, there are some business groups that I am sure we could walk into that are not like Real Leaders, that are not certified B Corps, that are not impact companies, that we would have this conversation and they would look at us like, what are you talking about? Like, the people on this call already have a foundation of impact. We all have, you know, as you know, social and environmental responsibility is already in our DNA. And so that's where I think a transition to employee ownership is very possible. And it is something that is, you know, we can have a good conversation about it and talk about it and see it, you know, but there are some companies who do not see this as a possibility. And so this is not for everyone. I wish it were, but, you know, so I see some questions have come through, so I want to make sure we have time for those.
Of course. Well, hey, well said, Elaine, Miran, thank you so much. Let's give them a quick round of applause, maybe in the group chat or just on your screens. Amazing conversation today. Truly, this is eye-opening. And I just, again, personally, I'm learning so much from you both. We do have a lot of questions here today. I'm going to go one by one. Well, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to pin whoever kind of raises their hand on the screen or if you asked a question in the chat. So you can either raise your hand with a reaction like this, like I'm doing right now. And then I'll pin you on the screen. Please unmute yourself, ask your question, and then we'll go to the next one. So I believe the first one's up here. Let me just have pin here. There we go. And then unmute yourself and go ahead and ask your question.
Enjoyed this discussion. Thank you so much. And Miran and Elaine, I mean, you talked about a couple of different things that is interesting to me. Now, I'm not running a business. However, I'm running my project as a business, and it involves getting over 6,000 employees engaged and wanting to row the same way you're rowing, right? So you talked about cultural alignment. You talked about, and one thing, Miran, you mentioned about from an equity perspective, you know, you have set goals where you have to have 2,500 hours of, you know, performance for you to be part of that that profit sharing. So how do you, in the beginning, I know as part of the employee, yes, you own a piece of the company, but to share the profits, you have this. How do you make sure right from the get-go as an employee that you have a stake in it? Because there's a big cultural piece with, oh, the company's doing great, I'm gonna earn my salary, not necessarily have to put in my 2,500 hours. Mm-hmm. Just happy with that. What do you do to engage so that you have maximum performance from your employees, whether they're getting the profit at the end or not? And I think Elaine, you mentioned the impact. So are you in it for the impact? Are you in it for the equity? Are you in it for something else?
Well, I'll let Miran start and then I'll piggyback off of her comments.
And let's try and keep the answers under 2 minutes each. Just want to make sure we get through everybody.
Cool. So we talk about it all the time. We talk about ownership thinking all the time. We talk about accountability and responsibility. I work with young team members. So I have a lot of team members who are in high school and college. We have our age group is from 16 to 82. So there's a very wide spectrum. It's very different. So we're doing a lot of first jobs. This is a lot of their first timers. That's why we have those 2,500 hours, because we have so many high schoolers. We have some that college kids that work with us and leave and then come back and then leave and then come back, you know. So, but we talk about it all the time. It's that idea of constant gentle pressure. You know, it is, and we do that with a lot of our different things. It's always being talked about. It's always there. It's a part of our culture. We are just always kind of talking about the same messages. And so, you know, and we started 2 years ago on ownership thinking. We've been doing a lot of other leadership development, but now it really is just part of it. Now, with that being said, we have a third, you know, I've heard it said a third. A third of our people are ready to run through a wall and do whatever it takes. Ownership, let's go. A third are learning, unsure. A third, I just want to do my job. Let's get this done. Let's go. What's going on? And maybe they'll come to it in a little while after they start to get some checks, you know, but I've got to really focus on the first two thirds. That's where I'm spending my energy.
Well said, Elaine.
Yeah, just once again, I started working at Nordstrom in my 20s. And what I loved about working there was you're not an owner, but you're asked to make decisions as if you were an owner, right? Every decision impacts the bottom line, and you can be a part of that and add to that and be responsible for that. And I think what Miren was saying is having that conversation of what's everybody's role to the bottom line, right? What's everybody's role to the impact and to the mission of the organization, even as a project, to be talking about that early and often, I think is the key. Just as Miren pointed out, I do this in my company, I do it in my nonprofit, and I try to do it in any projects that I participate in.
Johnson, thank you so much. We're going to bring on Mark here next.
Yeah, I was wondering, how are you financing the buyout of your shares for the trust?
So in our situation, I'm doing seller financing. With the ESOP and both with the EOT, I could go to the bank. There were many banks who were ready to finance this deal. I chose to do seller financing because, you know, having gone through COVID, I want the flexibility. If there's a tougher month or something comes up, I am a lot more flexible than the bank's going to be. I did have to, you know, I do have to charge a certain amount of interest because you don't want it to be a gift. You don't want the same with the price of that you've negotiated with the trust. So, but it is, I have 100% seller financing. I don't know if Elaine has done it or seen it any other way.
I've seen it with seller financing and I've seen it with traditional financing. So I think this is if it's seller financing, if the seller can bear that, then that's all the better for all the reasons that Miren shared.
Great question.
Could I just follow up to that? Because for this to be kind of more mainstream, because I'm looking at a perpetual purpose trust, you know, it would need to be something that is financeable. Otherwise, you're in essence giving the company to the employees. And some people can do that, but probably most, you know, can't or won't. So, when you were talking about the mainstream financing, what kind of loan to value were they talking? Kind of give us some of the ideas of what it looked like.
In our situation, they were looking to finance about 40%. That was the most that we would have been able to get. I don't know if Elaine has seen anything else.
I was going to say, yeah, it's going to be more, you can just bank on it being 25% or more. So like, just go with that and know that's what it's going to be.
Good.
Mark, thanks for your question. We're going to bring up Jim Black next.
Well, Mark's question actually dovetails a lot with my question, which was, you know, how the economics of the sale work. Obviously, you know, we work with a lot of founders of impact businesses, and for many of those founders, you know, what they've built together with their partners and employees over many years is their retirement, right? It is how they, you know, the equity value in their business is absolutely critical for their financial health. And so my question was very similar. How do you, you know, what does the sale look like? Is it on the same economic terms as it would be if you sold, for example, the private equity Miren? Is it, you know, do you go out and get a a business valuation, a going concern valuation, a DCF, or whatever it is, and that's actually the value that you assign when you sell it to the trust?
Absolutely. That's it. I actually had three valuations because I was wanting to make sure. And I did one with the ESOP, one with the private valuation, because looking at private equity, and then again with the trust. So yes. And we had one DCF. I mean, we had a couple of different things there that we were looking at in terms of, you know, because I'm holding the seller's note, it's paid out of cash flow of the business. So, you know, I could have done a shorter term and then there would have been less profit to share with the team members. I wanted the team members to have profit in the early years so that they really own buy into it. Yeah. So I extended the note further, a lot of different things. But yes, the valuation is done just like any other any other business valuation. And I think I did very well. I think I had a healthy exit, you know, in terms of what I could have done. Maybe I could have done more with a strategic who really wants the Miami area. But I feel very comfortable with what I got.
Jim, great question.
Thank you.
All right, Gerhard will be coming up next. Gerhard.
Yeah, thanks. You guys are awesome. Appreciate it. I originally had similar question to Mark and Jim, which I think have been pretty much. I shrink it down to what do you consider the most beneficial and not so beneficial thing of going that route versus just selling the company, right? The impact aside, right? We all are impact companies, so we know that our heart is in it, and you know we don't want to see it become the next Disney or whatever. But other than that, ups and downs of that.
Yeah, I'll start. Well, just going back to my story, right? So when I talk about, you know, I'm the first generation in my family to go to college. So I'm in a very different position as far as building wealth than maybe somebody else. So it was really important to me in thinking about how I leverage my intellectual property into this nonprofit and what happens to that nonprofit and it going into a trust that then I'm now no longer responsible for the growth pattern of that organization, which is going to financially impact me, right? So for me, there was this like 100% clear financial, my financial impact, right? But that once again, because of the structure of the nature of the relationships that I had with these other folks, they still wanted me to be somehow connected to it. And they were willing to like bend over backwards to figure out because the bond that we had as impact conveners was so valuable and so important. And they loved me and trusted me and still they wanted to keep me close. And I wanted to be close to them, quite frankly. But so we're just looking, finding other ways to do that. But I think back to what Miren was saying, it's what's right for you, what's right for the organization, what's right for the employees, and hopefully finding that there's concentric circles around those things. And with the big umbrella being the impact, whatever, regardless of what that impact or equity is. But if one of those bubbles is all the way out, it makes it quite much more difficult to make anything work and much more difficult to make it sustainable.
Yeah.
Okay, so interesting. You know, I was thinking a couple of different angles. Is one is if I were a CEO that was ready to hand over the keys and walk away, maybe this would not have been the best way, because I do think that I needed to be there to continue it going, especially if I have the seller financing, you know. So if I wanted to hand the keys over, walk away, maybe private equity would have been better if there was not an earnout or something like that. But then the other thing is I want to be here. You know, I don't want to leave. I started this company when I was almost 22 years old, and I'm still here and I still want to be here. So I can stay. But the other thing is too, is that I can keep it going the way I'd like it to stay. You know, had we sold to private equity, I know what they, you know, I've seen what they've done to other organizations around the US. And it's usually about cutting, you know, B Corp and all the, we call it the fluffy stuff that we do, you know, all the social and environmental, we're members of 1% for the planet. And we donate a lot of money to a lot of different organizations that might have changed had different investors come into the mix. now that's protected, that's there. And then the, finally, the other thing that I'm really happy about is that I think it's a good investment. You know, I'm holding the seller note, I'm making some interest, and I, you know, I'm invested in something I want to know, I know well. So if I had received this big bulk of money and put it into the market, you know, there are pros and cons to that as well. So, you know, I'm having a hard time coming up with something really the negative part of it. But I think if I wanted to just walk away and not and go sit on the beach in Tahiti, I'm not sure this would have been the best route for me, because I do need to stay. I do have a leadership, strong leadership team, but I don't think that they're 100% ready for me to be away yet. That makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Thank you. Sure. Just a very short follow-up. I hope it's short. What happens if you change your mind next week and, you know, something happens and you go like, you know what?
I want to be part of it. Absolutely. Now, I'm a co-owner with all of my team members. So if I decide to leave, I no longer get a profit share at the end of the year. Do you know what I mean? Like I am, and I've been communicating that to them as well, as I was 100% owner on February 29th, and now I'm a co-owner along with all of my team members. So the same rules apply to me. So if I do walk away, I do walk away. And so, yes, that could happen. You know, I mean, we all know anything could happen. And I am grooming somebody, you know, I'm grooming the team to continue on without me. And I think that, you know, they would do okay. But right now I am, that's my role.
But you know, it would remain, right? I mean, you would give up your
note would say, oh yeah, I could walk away tomorrow if I needed to. Yep. I still have the seller note. Everything is there.
Awesome. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. We have time for one more question. And that's Carolyn. You just chimed in. Carolyn.
One of the things that has held us back from, we wanted to do this from the beginning, and being a B Corp is in our DNA and is very important to us. But we are also a certified woman-owned business. And that being said, we do not only employ women. And in order to remain a woman-owned business, we have to make sure that, you know, that the equity remains with women. And I'm wondering if any of you have any insights into how to deal with that.
I would look at how valuable or important is that? Is that important to you personally as the founder? Is that important to you because of the contracts that you're getting? Because there's also this other benefit of the establishment of an employee-owned trust or an ESOP or a cooperative, right? So I would encourage you to not look at these things as mutually exclusive, or even that you're trading them off. You're moving into something different. And once again, I think going back to what Miran is saying is like, what if you're the founder, what is it you want to do? I will be perfectly honest, I'm not interested in owning a 1,000-year company. that's not part of my theory of change or ethos. But if that is, then those are the things that I need to go into your decision making. But I want to open up your mind and not think so narrowly around it's this or it's that, but that you're creating a different opportunity that has also different options. But if you have contracts that are connected to that designation, then once again, that's a question of whether or not this is something for you, or you become an organization that is female, all female, or largely female. So like, those are the things you have to think about, but love to hear what Miran has to say.
Well, you know, we have been 100% women owned for a long time, but I never got the designation. But now out of our 50 co-owners, 78% of them identify as women. 94% identify as minority, either Hispanic or Black, because, and also 34 were born in another country. So I think that whether they're women or not, or that there's just such value in that statement, because these are immigrants that have come to this country that are working really hard and contributing. So employee ownership can do so many different things. And I feel like it doesn't have to be an either or. Maybe it's a yes and kind of thing. Yeah.
Love it. Well, hey, just appreciate everyone spending time. I know an hour out of everyone's day is a lot. So thank you so much for just taking time to be here with Elaine, Miran, and myself on this April member only event. We hope you enjoyed it just as much as we did. If there's one thing I'm taking away from this is this, you learn so much from just going on the journey regardless. So if your journey is starting today, we want to hear from you. Mirren's, one of her personal missions is to inspire more of these employee-owned businesses. So we want to hear from you. Happy to make connections. Happy to kind of put you on this journey, of course, inspire the future of business. Thank you so much for being on the call today. Elaine, Mirren, any final words?
Just do it.
Yeah. And reach out for anything at all. Absolutely. So thank you, Kevin. We appreciate you holding this.
Of course. All right. Thank you, everybody. Enjoy the rest of your Thursday.